This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. This week, a New York doctor helps refugees who've been tortured find asylum in the U.S. And fun with fungi at a village scavenger hunt in Mexico.
There are 10 of us walking through a pine forest, all with our eyes on the ground, looking for mushrooms.
In China, a rare safe haven for kids whose parents are in prison. And the music of Gurumol, all the way from Australia.
That voice is really incredible. I mean, it's pure, it's soothing, it's sad, it's nostalgic, it's trance-inducing. It's really, really, really beautiful.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Each year, tens of thousands of people who are fleeing torture, persecution, or even death in their homeland end up here in the U.S. looking for protection. But before they're allowed to stay, they have to prove to immigration officials that their horror stories are true. In New York City, there's a doctor who helps these refugees show proof of persecution. Sarah Kate Kramer reports.
Dr. Ramin Asghari runs a free clinic on the Upper East Side. His patients are members of an exclusive group, not because of their net worth, but because of what they've been through in their native countries. All of them are seeking asylum in the U.S. Dr. Asghari sits in a chair and listens to a man from India describe being tortured by the police because of his religion and caste. A sound system pipes his words into the room next door, where medical students watch the exam through an observation window. Later, Asghari will examine the man's body for physical scars and take photographs of the marks left by clubs and knives. The doctor is used to seeing such terrible things.
We have burn marks. We have scars from sharp objects, as well as the penetrating objects, such as bullets. And then we see a lot of scars from blunt trauma, and these are basically patches of different coloration in the skin, or deformity on the bone, or different parts of the body.
Asylum seekers must prove they have a well-founded fear of harm or persecution in their home country because of their race, religion, nationality, social group, or political opinion. But it's difficult to do that. Last year, more than 47,000 applications were filed, but less than 23% were granted. One reason? Asylum seekers often don't have the resources to assemble strong court cases and must convince judges on their testimony alone. To help in this process, Dr. Asghari writes a report on his medical findings, both physical and psychological, and submits them to immigration court. Dr. Asghari, who's originally from Iran, first emigrated to France and joined the humanitarian organization Doctors Without Borders. That's when he saw firsthand the plight of refugees. Later in the U.S., he continued treating refugees at the Bronx Human Rights Clinic. And 2 years ago, he set up a similar clinic at Mount Sinai Hospital, where he teaches medical students and encourages them to see human rights work as part of their responsibility as doctors.
The way that I see it is that we have pure medical illness such as diabetes, and this is a social illness, which is torture, which is human rights abuses, and has implications on people's health, mentally and physically. They tell you, help me, so I can be a person like you in this community that torture doesn't exist.
That's why Baraka Yakubu walked into Dr. Asghari's Health and Human Rights Clinic last year. Yakubu is from northern Ghana, a region plagued with ethnic conflict. Her father was a powerful political figure, and after his death, she and her family were the targets of harassment and violence. Many of her relatives were killed in attacks on her town.
They chase you, or they follow you, they beat you up, they burn down homes. That's how it is back home.
Yakubu left her town to attend college in a nearby city where she thought she'd be safer, but her last name made her stand out. Classmates yelled insults at her, and one horrible night in what she believes was a politically motivated attack, Yakubu was raped on campus. Afraid for her life, she decided to leave the country. In 2006, Yakubu acquired a coveted 5-year visa to the U.S. and came to New York. Even though she knew it was dangerous, she returned to Ghana last fall to vote in the national elections. But when she tried to register, she was threatened by a police officer.
He said, it's getting to election time and you guys are trooping in again. We know who you are and we know who you're going to vote for. And even if you register, you're not going to live to vote.
In fear for her life, she decided to return to the U.S. But at Kennedy Airport, Yakubu was stopped by U.S. security agents. They said she'd broken the terms of her visa. She should have been leaving the U.S. every 6 months. They told her they were going to send her back to Ghana. Yakubu pleaded with the officers to let her stay in America.
What I know is that I can't go home now. If I go home, I'll be harmed. I could be killed. You know, the fact that I'm my father's only child left, I'm just scared that something could happen to me if I go home, and I don't want to die young.
Eventually, Yakubu found a lawyer who referred her to Dr. Asghari's clinic. Asghari documented physical scars from the rape, as well as psychological distress resulting from trauma. She said going over each and every scar was an emotional ordeal, one Dr. Asghari understands.
When they come, they have a lot of fears, and I have to prove myself. Like, I have been abused. Now I have to prove myself to yet another person. And this person is a doctor. Everybody listen to them.
In the end, Dr. Asghari's affidavit added important heft to Yakubu's case. The immigration judge ruled it was likely she'd be persecuted if sent back to Ghana and that she warranted protection in the United States.
Sometimes I feel I'm dreaming, you know, just walking outside. I feel so relieved and excited for the fact that they're not going to send me back home.
Dr. Asghari says helping refugees is rewarding work, but it's no simple task. When mentoring medical students, he teaches them to care for patients who are revealing the most painful episodes of their lives.
How to open up the question, how to follow the cues, how you create a trustful relationship, and how to be independent observer here, but yet supportive for a person who has been suffering potentially. There is art in it.
There are an estimated 75,000 torture survivors in the New York metropolitan area. So sadly, Dr. Asghari has no shortage of clients. But with a fleet of young doctors training in the clinic, he's hoping to help even more asylum seekers in the near future. For the World Vision Report, I'm Sarah Kramer in New York.
Baraka Yakubu came to the U.S. from northern Ghana, and as you've just heard, ethnic tensions there have led to violent conflict. But the southern part of Ghana is peaceful. That's where you'll find Mama Susanna. She has a stall at the local market, and she's got some advice on how to keep customers coming back. Anna Boyko-Wyrock brings us Mama Susanna's story as part of our ongoing street vendor series.
Susanna Asamoah wakes up every morning with a prayer.
I have to thank God. After I'm done thanking Him, I have to commit all the people around me to the hands of God. After that, I also leave my business in the hands of God so that He should guide me and make my products sell.
Susanna sells fish for a living. She leaves her house at 5:30, 6 days a week, to catch a bus. After a dusty, bumpy ride into the center of town, Susanna arrives at her first stop of the day, the wholesale market, where she buys her fish. There's a crush of women on the sidewalk in front of the refrigerated shops. Armed with machetes, they hack apart frozen clumps of fish, separating individual mackerel and red snapper. Susanna knows most of the people here. She jokes around as she makes her way through the market, picking out the best fish. The vendors pack her selections in cardboard boxes. The frozen fish is really heavy, so to get them to the market, Susanna hires a porter, sometimes a man with a wheelbarrow, other times a lady with a baby on her back. Kejetia Market is one of the busiest in Africa. The stalls are tightly jammed together. Rows of blue, pink, and black fish line the food section. Ghanaians in this part of the country eat a lot of fish. Susanna has changed into her work clothes, a navy blue turtleneck and gray skirt. They're flecked with fish scales. Her stall is little more than a table on a raised platform and a large red umbrella to keep the sun off. Pretty soon, one of Susanna's loyal customers stops by. Whenever I buy the fish from her, she says, she's good to me. Sometimes she even takes out the small ones and gives me bigger ones instead. Susanna prepares the fish for her customer, scraping off the scales. slicing off the fins, gutting it, and chopping off the mouth. She wraps the purchase in cardboard to keep it fresh. Then she puts the whole thing in a black plastic bag. Susanna's been doing this for 30 years and says it's hard work.
When a customer comes, you work on their fish for them. By the time you finish, your arms ache all over. When you come home in the evening, your body aches all over.
Recently, higher fuel prices have pushed up the price of a lot of things. The fish Susanna buys wholesale got more expensive, so she had to increase her own prices. She used to sell a stack of small fish for about $1. Now the same product goes for more than $3. That's a big change for most people here. Shoppers in the market started to grumble about it, so Susanna stepped up her customer service to retain business.
Even if the customer is upset with you, you shouldn't follow along. You should be patient and just let her talk. And when she's finished, you should let her know that it's not your fault, but the price of things have increased. It's because they've increased the price of the gas. That's why it happened. When you say that, she'll understand.
On a good day, after covering her costs, Susanna makes around $7. But on some days, she can't even cover the price of the fish she buys in the morning. That makes things hard, because right now, she's the only breadwinner in the house.
Besides what I earn at the market, I don't have any extra money to buy food. So if I didn't come to the market, it would be tough.
She aspires to sell fish at the wholesale market, known as the cold store. But asked if she saved up to start a business there, she laughs, sadly.
You can't make enough profit to open a cold store.
Lack of capital is keeping Susanna poorer than she says she could be, given her experience and knowledge of local commerce. But despite her low wages, she's generous with what she has. Susanna takes care of a number of village teenagers. Visitors who show up at her door always get fed well. Usually, it's a big portion of fish stew. For the World Vision Report, I'm Anna Boy Kawairok in Kumasi, Ghana.
And this is what you might hear in the marketplace right now. It's the 2009 Song of the Year in Ghana called Angelina, and it's performed by the Ghanaian hip life trio called Pray. And in Australia, the music of Aboriginal singer Gurumul is hitting the charts. We'll introduce you to him and his music a little later in the show. Stay with us for the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire with the World Vision Report. There are around 1.5 million inmates in China's prisons, but no one really knows how many of their children have been left struggling on the outside. The children are often shunned by society, and they fall through the cracks of China's welfare system. Most of them are left to fend for themselves. But there's an organization working to change that. Reporter Elise Pataka has more.
It's mid-morning at Sun Village on the outskirts of Beijing. A group of teenage boys play a lazy game of basketball on a sun-scorched court. Just behind them, in a shady vegetable garden lined with bright yellow sunflowers, younger children pick armloads of tomatoes and peppers. While it looks a little bit like a summer camp, for these children, Sun Village is home. And with its colourful grounds, library and bungalows where the children sleep, it's the very opposite of what many of them have experienced before.
I'm so happy because there are many children play with me, and there is a big family, and there are a lot of teachers love me.
Hot off the basketball court and wearing an NBA tank top, 15-year-old Yan Jia tells me he came here after his mother, an alleged victim of domestic violence, killed his father. She's now in prison serving a lengthy sentence. He's able to phone her at special times, like China's Spring Festival, and visit her once a year.
She always asks me about my health and whether I'm getting enough to eat.
Sun Village is home to around 130 children, and all of them have at least one parent behind bars. As a group of children play marbles, the charity's founder, Zhang Xuqin, talks with staff about a new boy who's just come into their care. Zhang used to work in prison administration.
Many of the prisoners' children were forgotten by society. No one was looking after them. Some had become beggars, others had stopped school. Because of a lack of supervision, some were also going down a criminal path.
Children of prisoners in China are not eligible for government support, since they're not legally classified as orphans. Often relatives and family friends might be financially unable or even unwilling to take them in.
Discrimination is common. In traditional China, one person's crime could implicate the entire family.
For the children of prisoners, the psychological impact can be huge.
It can result in different types of emotional problems, from being withdrawn to violent behavior. So here at Sun Village, we have counselors for those who would like to talk. For others, we have special activities like martial arts, embroidery, and acting.
In the Sun Village cafeteria at lunchtime, the children sit in groups around massive bowls of steaming noodles and soup. The older children serve the younger ones. Some of these kids were brought here by prison staff. Others are dropped off by relatives or neighbours. There are now 6 Sun Villages throughout the country, caring for around 400 children. The homes rely on donations and sell fruit from their orchards for income. While there are a handful of similar organisations in China, supply far outstrips demand. The total number of prisoners' children in need is estimated to be in the hundreds of thousands. With their similar backgrounds and stories, the children here are very supportive of each other. 13-year-old Zhang Yu, who wants to be a music teacher when she gets older, tells me the words she uses to comfort new arrivals. Don't cry, she tells them. All the children here are just the same as you. In a large activity room, Peng Yongjian plays a mean game of ping pong against her twin daughters. Peng works here, supervising the children. But it wasn't so long ago that she herself was behind bars, serving 5 years for covering up the whereabouts of her criminal husband.
At that time, I just cried the whole night. I was so worried. I didn't know where my two children were and if anyone was looking after them. I hated to think what could have happened to them.
Peng Yongjian went 6 months without any news about her daughters. She says she was so relieved to find out they were being well looked after at Sun Village. And now she encourages the other kids to keep in touch with their parents.
I tell the children to write their mothers often, to tell them that they don't need to worry because you have food, clothes to wear, and somewhere good to stay.
The children at Sun Village can talk to their parents by phone, and once a year they're able to visit them in jail. Zhang Xuqin says this contact is crucial, especially for the mothers.
Some of the mothers try to break out of jail, some commit suicide, and others break the rules of the prison. 65% of the time, this is related to the children. If they're not certain that their children have been placed in good homes, they have no chance of reforming themselves.
Back by the basketball court, 15-year-old Yan Jia quietly tells me that being separated from his mother can be difficult and says that he misses her. But he also has a motto which he lives by, one that he passes on to other kids when the going gets tough.
Life could be nothing without failures and frustrations.
Life is nothing without failures and frustrations, he says. A good student who's about to start his senior years of high school, Yan Jia is intent on learning from the challenges he's faced to build a brighter future. For the World Vision Report, I'm Elise Portaker in Beijing.
That's Jeffrey Gurumul Yunupingo. He's an Aboriginal Australian singer, and his latest solo release has won major musical awards in Australia. He's getting worldwide raves as well. All of this acclaim is bringing this singer, who happens to be blind, far from the remote island where he was born. World Vision Report's Lita Hartman spoke with Ishma Fundukwa, our guide to all things world music.
Hi Ish, welcome back to the show.
Hi Lida, thank you very much for having me again.
So the song we were just listening to, it's called Treaty by an Australian band called Yotu Yindi, and that band is arguably the best known Aboriginal band, I guess, in the world. And it was the band that Gurumul got his start in, and this song is pretty political, isn't it?
Very, very political. You know, the lyrics are almost all in English, and they're talking about words are easy, words are cheap, much cheaper than our priceless land. And also saying this land was never given up, this land was never bought and sold. So, you know, this is a very, very political song.
Now, I was in Australia last year, and my impression of the condition of a lot of Aboriginals there was that it was a little bit similar to Native Americans here in the States, where a lot of people lived in isolated communities. And the community where Gurumul grew up, it's in a state called the Northern Territory, which is where most Aboriginals live, and he grew up on this island off of the coast. What do you know about how he grew up and what his traditions were like?
Well, Gurumul was born blind, and like you rightly say, he was born on Elko Island. And apparently because he was blind, he did spend a lot of time with the elders listening to all the stories. And I mean, he's doing some of the storytelling in his own music, in his own the music that he composed himself, and also updating some of the traditional songs that he had as a child.
And what do you like about this guy in particular? What is it about his music that draws you?
That voice is really incredible. I mean, it's pure, it's soothing, it's sad, it's nostalgic, and I think I used this word again when we last spoke to each other. It's trance-inducing. It's really, really, really beautiful. His guitar playing is also really, really special.
He seems sort of like the Aboriginal answer to Stevie Wonder, you know, this blind child prodigy that just had oodles of talent from an early age, and it sounds like people really recognized that and nurtured it in him.
Yeah, you could draw parallels with Stevie Wonder, and also the fact that this guy doesn't only play the guitar. He's really multi-talented. He plays the keyboards, he plays drums, and of course he plays the didgeridoo, the Australian instrument. So he's a very, very special case. Child prodigy is the right way to describe him.
Let's hear a song in which he actually talks about his own situation. It's called Gurumul History, and it's about growing up in Elko Island and what it was like to be blind.
I heard my mama and my papa crying their heart. And tall.
sure is soulful.
He's very soulful, and there I think he sings in English as well. I think it's one of the two tracks on the album that he mixes Yolngu with English, and he's saying, "I was born blind, and I don't know why. God knows why, because he loves me so." Really beautiful lyrics.
You know, Ish, if I didn't know that Gurmul was a blind Aboriginal, just listening to him, I would think that he's like a Western folk rocker singing in an exotic accent. And he sounds very Western in places.
Absolutely, he sure does.
Now, you've said that he's played Aboriginal instruments like the didgeridoo, but he doesn't only do that. Can you tell me, like, what these Aboriginal instruments are and how much he uses them and how much he uses other instruments?
The didgeridoo is a wind instrument, which emits like a drone kind of sound. And then there's the clapsticks that they use that are self-explanatory, really. But on this particular album, I don't hear the didgeridoo or clapsticks. So it's a real departure from a traditional Aboriginal music. It's playing the guitar mostly, accompanied by a double bass.
Yeah, almost like a classical kind of instrumentation, something like that, very spare.
Absolutely, a bit of strings here and there. But I think, once again, I would like to emphasize his voice. I think that's what does it for a lot of people, including myself.
And he learned how to play the piano early on as well, right?
Yeah, as a kid, people realized that they had a special kid here, and then he got a guitar. But because he was left-handed, and this guitar was a right-handed guitar, he played it upside down, which he still does to this day, the wrong way up.
And even though, like, he doesn't change the strings to adjust it, anything like that, he just plays it the way he learned it?
He's just playing it the way he learned to play.
And it's an amazing sound. It's a really unique sound.
Beautiful.
So let's hear another tune from Gurmul's latest album. Is there one you especially like, Ish?
Yeah, there's this the song where he also sings in English, and Yolngu, a song called Baiwara. And his mother seems to come up in most of his songs because he starts off, "I heard my mother from the long distance, making me cry." And I think he must be very close to his mother, or maybe it's a cultural thing, I don't know. It is beautiful stuff.
He may not sound typically Aboriginal. In this song, I really hear the eagles, like, all over the place.
Yeah.
But even though his sound isn't typically Aboriginal, he seems to have a lot of themes that kind of harken back to his culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of these songs are traditional songs that he's updating, and some of them are songs that he wrote himself, but he's all grounding his tribe. And this is what he's bringing to a wider audience. I don't hear him writing music the way it is written by Western pop artists. It's purely from where he's coming from.
And what kind of success has he had recently with that? Would you say, like, he's successfully crossed over, if you will, into mainstream success?
No question about that. I think he's maybe one of the most popular artists in Australia at the moment, and they've been showering him with awards, and which is kind of pretty interesting, because Gurmul does not give interviews. He sits in on his own interviews. Like, when he's being interviewed, I've heard him being interviewed on the radio, and his producer and bass player, and I guess his best friend, Michael Hornan, who's a white guy, answers the questions for him. And every once in a while, he chips in, he throws in a word if he thinks Michael has missed something or he wants to emphasize something. But he does not give interviews. He's wary of the media. He's not into the fame thing.
It's fascinating. It sounds like success has not gone to his head, and he's also okay with someone else speaking for him. That's pretty different.
He speaks through his music. That's what he's good at. And I find that kind of fascinating, but also really smart, because a lot of musicians who are really good musicians, when they are interviewed, they do put both feet into their mouth.
So he keeps his feet out of his mouth, at least. Well, do you have another one that you'd like us to listen to?
Yeah, the next selection is a song called Wire Tool.
that's a real lullaby, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is.
I'm wondering, you know, you have watched a lot of artists on the world music scene. Do you think we'll be seeing a lot more of him? Do you think he'll be able to cross over, even beyond Australia, into a sort of a bigger world music scene?
I think he's already done that. He's toured in your part of the world, in the United States, got some very, very good reviews in newspapers such as the New York Times. To begin with, just making it in Australia as an Aboriginal is already a mega achievement because of the racial politics in that country. Despite the fact that this guy was born blind, you listen to some of his words and it's like he's describing things that you and I can see. I find that pretty amazing. And they also say he does not have a guide dog or seldom walks with a white stick. So I really don't know how he manages that, but he's a very remarkable character. Also, you know, there's some write-ups that say that while he was growing up as a kid, people in the village used to guide him as he tried to ride the push bike. So maybe this is where walking around unaided and unguided comes from.
And it also shows how nicely his own village came together to support him in every way, not just musically, but also in terms of functioning every day.
They were his eyes.
Well, let's go out on one more song from Gurumul. What will it be, Ish?
I guess we'll play one of your favorites from the album, a song called Galiku.
Thank you so much, Ish. It's a pleasure to talk to you about Gurumul. We sure appreciate it.
Lida, it was my pleasure. I really enjoy this guy's music, and I think he's a really, really nice guy who deserves all the success that he has coming to him.
Ish Mafundukwa is our world music tour guide. He spoke to us from his home in Harare, Zimbabwe. Next, mushrooms and music from Mexico. That's all ahead on the World Vision Report, the show that brings you close to the lives of people in the developing world. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Tourists flock to the Mexican state of Oaxaca. Pristine beaches, ancient archaeological sites, and the colonial capital city are the main draws. But mushrooms? Turns out Oaxaca's northern mountainous region teems with mushrooms during the rainy season. So that's when you'll find foreign visitors foraging for fungi and feasting on mushrooms, all at a special mushroom festival. Reporter Shannon Young has the story.
It's standing room only on this bus coming from Oaxaca City. Many of these passengers are headed to the mountain village of Guajimaloyas for the mushroom festival. Soon after arrival, we're split into groups of 10, each one with a local guide. The groups will compete in a contest to fill a large basket with as many different types of mushrooms as possible. Each participant has paid a registration fee, and the proceeds go to the town's ecotourism project. Local guide Maria Luisa Martinez leads my group. Immediately after entering a lush pine forest, we encounter our first mushroom.
Es un hongo amanita. Pero este hongo no es comestible.
Maria Luisa explains what we have found is a toxic amanita mushroom. After cutting a specimen at the stem with a blunt knife, Maria Luisa gives us our first lesson on foraging protocol.
Cuando un hongo se arranca, se tapa,
when you pick a mushroom, you have to cover up the spot where it was, especially if it's an edible variety, because the spores have already fallen there. So you have to cover it back up so that the mushrooms will sprout again there the next year.
There are 10 of us walking through a pine forest, all with our eyes on the ground, looking for mushrooms. They just found a mushroom that they call a squirrel mushroom because the mushrooms are eaten by squirrels. They're only for squirrels. Humans don't eat them.
Soon after, we find a scaly purple-black mushroom with gills under its cap. Maria Luisa says it's a killer, like the amanita we found earlier.
Some others are also fatally toxic, but you can eat some poisonous mushrooms and not die immediately. Rather, you suffer pain and die later. There's no cure.
4 hours later, all of the groups head into a clearing with our baskets loaded down with mushrooms, edible, poisonous, and hallucinogenic. We lay out the contents of our baskets onto wooden tables. Two young judges look over the mushrooms on display from each group. Our group weighed in with 38 different species. The winning group had a whopping 82 different species in their basket. Pablo Ruiz happened upon the mushroom gathering by accident. He was hiking in the forest with his son and was pleasantly surprised to find the normally secluded meadow filled with people and mushrooms.
It was amazing how many different varieties of mushrooms there were. So it was like a very interesting junction of people, all community people, people from the city, all joined together to hike on the mountains and pick the mushrooms and all the culture that is around that activity, no?
This year was said to be the worst in a while for mushroom foraging due to a drought that's been affecting most of Mexico. Despite that, the forest still had enough mushrooms to supply a communal buffet the next day, featuring five different dishes, all based on, you guessed it, mushrooms. For the World Vision Report, I'm Shannon Young in Cuajimaloyas, Oaxaca.
There are some great pictures of the Mushroom Festival on our website, worldvisionreport.org.
Sueño, mamá, contigo toda la noche cuando me quiero despertar. No puedo, no puedo. Sueño que estoy en un camino muy largo que conduce al mar y estás tú esperando, esperando.
In her latest book, author Julia Alvarez writes about Mexicans who've left their country and their culture behind. They're among the millions of undocumented workers who come to the U.S. each year to find work on farms and in factories. They live in fear of being sent back to Mexico. In her book, Return to Sender, Alvarez takes a personal look at the lives of the people behind the thorny immigration debate. We've invited Julia Alvarez onto the show to talk about her children's book. Welcome to the show, Julia. We're glad to have you.
Thank you for having me.
You cover a lot of complicated issues in your book. The topic of family farms in this country having a tough time surviving and farmers needing to hire undocumented workers just to keep their farms alive. How did you come up with the idea to write this book?
I often say that I don't get ideas. If an idea knocked on my door and asked me to write a book about it, I would run the other way because ideas are kind of abstract. It's more a pebble in my shoe kind of thing. Something happens, it kind of troubles me or puzzles me, and I can't seem to stop thinking about it, and I try to shake it out of my head, but there it is again. So what happened is that here in Vermont, in the year 2000, there were only 3,504 Latinos in all of Vermont. But then what started to happen in about the last 6-7 years is I would get calls from neighbor farmers asking me to come over and translate because they had some Mexicans that didn't know how to work the milking machine. And once or twice I got a call from the hospital asking me to come translate for a worker that had had a farm accident. And I knew something was going on when I started to be asked by some of the schools to come over because they had some little Mexican kids and they didn't know how to communicate with them. And it turns out that overnight, 6-7 years, there were 500 undocumented Mexican migrant workers just in my county doing all the milking and all the dairy farms. When I went to the schools, I saw that here were these farm kids, their parents farms were in trouble, but here were these new people that had come in. They had to be kept sort of a secret. Homeland Security would raid the farms, and these raids called Return to Sender, Operation Return to Sender, would raid their farms. And I thought, we need a story to understand what is happening to us.
Let's talk about the kids, the 11 and 12-year-old main characters in your book. One is 11-year-old Tyler, and he's the son of a farmer, and he actually starts out pretty skeptical of his family hiring undocumented workers. He didn't know anything about them. And the other main character, Mari, who's about the same age,
was born in Mexico. She's the daughter of the migrant worker. And she's really scared her family's going to be caught and sent back, like you talked about. Now, I know these two kids are fictional, but they're telling stories that are actually happening all across the country. How would you describe these two kids and the predicaments they find themselves in, if you could sum it up for us, their characters?
Well, Tyler's a little Vermont farm boy. Generations of his family have been farming the land. He loves the farm. His father has a farm accident, and all of a sudden they're having to think about selling the farm because he can't find enough local help, and he can't afford it. So yeah, they're in that predicament, and Tyler is really upset about this. So, of course, he's very glad when a solution is found to get these new workers that are willing to work on the farm for less, long hours. And so he's happy about that, but he's also a little patriot. You know, he loves his country, and he's been taught by his clean-nosed dad that, you know, you always follow the rules. So suddenly he's asked not to talk about the family, the Mexican farm family on his farm, and he's not quite sure if they are obeying the law or not, and this troubles him. So you have that character. And then you have Mari, who's come up with her father and two younger sisters who were born in this country, in the United States, but she was born in Mexico, and she's the one that feels divided about, is she Mexican? Is she American? What's going to happen? Will her family get divided? So you have two characters who are in conflict, which is what, you know, creates a story. Something has to happen.
You have this theme of fear running through it, the fear that many times these immigrants live with day in and day out. You have a section in there that I thought was very interesting. It was Halloween, and the Mexican family lives in this trailer on the farm, and they're terrified when the trick-or-treaters come knocking at the door. Can you describe that scene for us?
It allowed me a very, very interesting contrast because, of course, in the Mexican culture, people really celebrate the Day of the Dead. I mean, back home, they go to their cemeteries and they bring the favorite foods of the deceased relative. They play the music they would have liked, and they have like a party. But in the United States, what we have is Halloween. People dress up as goblins and witches and go trick-or-treating on doors. But when they come to the trailer, the farm workers have been very nervous that they're going to be raided and grabbed and deported. And so when a ring comes at night to their door, they're terrified.
In your book, the two characters, Mari and Tyler, are on the farm together and in school together, and they really develop a sweet friendship. Do you think this is a good depiction of what really happens? Or I'm wondering if these two very different cultural groups stay separated, if the kids really don't come together like this.
Well, part of the research that I did for the book was go to farms. These farm kids, Vermont farm kids, are also isolated. They're out in the middle of nowhere with their families. And suddenly they have these new playmates. And so in this one farm family, Josue, the little boy, and the farmer's son and the farmer's daughter were like a little gang. They were having the best time. They're hanging out together.
What is it that you want young readers to understand through the story of these two kids?
You hear about all these issues and their abstractions, and there are different arguments going on and different points of view, and it's all up there in the theory. And it's actually things that are happening to real people. And so what I want is for us to get inside the human situation. I don't have an answer. So I just want us to enter fictionally into the lives of people in this situation and just feel the full complexity, the emotions, the different pulls that both young kids feel. And therefore, when we address the complex issues or are involved in the argument, we don't divorce it from the real people that it's happening to.
Julia Alvarez, author of Return to Sender. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You heard Julia Alvarez mention the Mexican festival, Day of the Dead. Well, it's that time of year again, El Día de los Muertos. It's not a sad time, in spite of the name. The festival originated with the indigenous people of Latin America, who believed that the souls of the dead return each year to visit their loved ones. So on the Day of the Dead, families place brightly colored marigolds and candles on gravestones to guide departed ones home. Then they picnic in the cemetery and keep an all-night vigil, waiting for their loved ones to visit. And in homes, families set up altars to honor the dead, with framed photos, plates of their favorite foods, even a favorite toy. The celebration spills out onto the streets, where people dress up as cadavers, ghosts, and other ghoulish get-ups. It's a time for memories, merrymaking, and music, all part of the annual Dia de los Muertos. From the Day of the Dead to the City of the Dead. That's the name of a neighborhood in Cairo. It's a vast cemetery made up of rows of mausoleums, some modest, some elaborate, with simple dirt lanes in between. You'll find plenty of people in the cemetery, but they're not visiting. They live there, thousands of them. Some of them are there illegally. They broke into mausoleums that were old and forgotten. Others actually pay rent to the mausoleum owners. Theodore May visited the City of the Dead, and he sent us this reporter's notebook.
I had passed the cemetery many times and had heard that people actually live there. So one weekend, I had a taxi pull over on the shoulder of the highway, and I set off to see for myself. I turned down one lane, swerved around two stray dogs, and ducked under a clothesline that had been strung across the alley. Then I saw Ali Muhammad standing on the stoop of his mausoleum. Stout and impeccably groomed, Ali asked me what I was doing in his neighborhood, and before long, he invited me inside his house for tea. Ali and his family have a long relationship with the owner of the mausoleum, who allowed Ali's parents to build a tiny house in the tree-filled courtyard 4 decades ago, free of charge. To the left of the mausoleum's front door sits Ali's modest cement house, built using two perpendicular walls of the mausoleum itself. So yes, Ali has spent 40 years living here. Egypt's population is booming, and income levels are pitifully low, so many in the country have been forced to seek alternative forms of housing. Living in a cemetery may be the oddest of them all. My knees almost touched Ali's as we sat against opposite walls, but the four-room home was elaborately furnished, deep green chairs in the living room, a set of shelves with scores of trinkets by the bedroom, washed-out photographs with thick, intricately designed frames on the wall. As we chatted, Ali's son and two grandchildren joined him in the house, and the five of us meandered through a halting conversation in Arabic. Outside the door of the house, in the mausoleum courtyard, I could see two women shuttling laundry between a modern-looking washing machine and a dryer. Two others served tea to the men of the house, and me, their guest. Ali, who works as a taxi driver, explained that two of the women were family members. The other two, he said, lived nearby in the cemetery. The reason they were here was a sad one. Ali's wife had died just 4 days before, and these women had come each day since her death. Friends, family, and neighbors, he went on, pulled together in times like these. But what makes this act of charity even more impressive is the fact that the women, Ali said, would continue to come indefinitely. Ali's case is a prime example of how the many impoverished communities throughout Cairo form a strong safety net. They don't let people slip through. It's what allowed Ali and his family to live on the mausoleum grounds in the first place, and it's what will continue to bring those two women to his house each day. Ali and I walked back into the courtyard of the mausoleum as I prepared to leave. Pigeons sat atop the mausoleum's creamy yellow walls. Several trees provided a gentle shade around the sole headstone. Our visit ended with Ali repeatedly reminding me that I was welcome to return any time. I promised I would, but I'm not even sure I could find my way back to his place, on one of the hundreds of indistinguishable streets in the City of the Dead.
Theodore May is a reporter based in Cairo.
Mon, 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 mon.
And that brings us to the end of our show this week. Don't forget you can see photos to go with our stories on our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can also read blogs from our reporters around the world, and you can tell us what you think of the show. We always like to hear your feedback. Our show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer, and Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. I'm Peggy Waymire.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization. ما تنسيني.